Okay, I hope everybody can hear me. If you're having any trouble hearing me, please email me or write me and let me know. Okay, so hi everybody. This is Stephanie Wu. Welcome to the second session of the Master's Course. So last week we talked about the first two of the four planes of development. And we traveled through time, you know, we started with the newborn, who then, you know, potentially went to the NIDO, and then we went on to the toddler classroom for the child who's walking up to 2.5, and then he went to the primary classroom from 2.5 to 6, and then we ended up with the elementary child between 6 and 12. Now, I don't know if maybe some of you were sitting there wondering, well, why should I know about these things? You know, it's not like I'm going to be a teacher, you know, maybe I might send my kids to a Montessori school, so they're kind of interesting, but, I mean, why do I care what uniforms they wear in a NIDO or what they teach in elementary school? Well, the reason why I decided I wanted to share that stuff with you is because when I first heard about it, I was really, personally, I was fascinated, okay? And when I learned about all of this, I was, you know, I'm also just a parent, and I had no plans to, you know, have a school or become a teacher or anything like that. But I thought it was interesting because I wanted to know, given the characteristics and needs of the children at these various stages, okay, what kind of environment did Montessori and Montessorians think were important to suit the needs of those children? So, for example, like, we know that it's important that children need order, right? But, like, how does that manifest on an everyday basis? You know, what would that look like? You know, what would help a child when he's at that stage? So I was amazed myself to know that something as small as the same colored clothing, right, the same uniform, remember all the adults wear the same colored uniform, and I did not know that that would really help a young baby's sense of order and communicate to the baby that when they see that color, they know that this person is here to help, okay? So just a little, you know, a little nugget like that, you know, it really helps you understand, oh, wow, like, that's how important it is. And, you know, even something as small as that could help them, can really help a young baby, right? You know, it was also really good for me to know that, you know, there's this elementary age child, you know, who's very black and white in his morality. You know, I've actually, you know, experienced that with my own nephews and nieces who are elementary age kids. You know, they're really, like, at an age where they're exploring values. You know, they want to know what feels good, what doesn't feel good, you know, and what they should be doing, right? And I thought it was fascinating that at school, the teacher's job is to foster an atmosphere so that children can learn to make their own rules. You know, they learn that they can call a class meeting if they don't like something, that they can learn to speak up for themselves, and they can learn to vote for or against what they want. Okay, so, you know, firstly, I want you to know about the changing behaviors, needs, and characteristics of the child, right, from infancy to early childhood to elementary school, and I want you to know that the people who have observed these things about children for 100 years now, I mean, that's how long this education has been around, they've discovered that there are certain things in the environment that really make a difference for children with these characteristics. Now, what I'm telling you is not the end-all, be-all. You know, this isn't everything. All Maria Montessori did, and what Montessorians continue to do today, was to observe children and then discover the universal characteristics of children and then design environments that, you know, they think would appeal to those characteristics. Then they tested these designs, you know, our real children, to see what they liked and what they didn't like, what worked and didn't work. And that's what Montessori education is about. That's it. Observing, designing the environment, and then testing those environments. You know, things that work, you keep. The things that don't work, you throw out. Okay? So, you know, I don't know if you guys have seen those Montessori mobiles for infants. Okay? You know, mobiles, they could be any design, right? But why do you think these are the ones we settle on? You know, Montessori mobiles are very, very specific. You know, we have the graded color balls. We have the red, blue, and green balls. We have the black and white Minari mobile. These are classic Montessori mobiles. And why is it that those are the ones that all Montessori classrooms and all Montessori homes use? because experiment after experiment have told us that these are the ones that babies love, okay? So when I tell you, like, something about maybe something that we do as Montessorians in a Montessori environment, it's really like a shortcut. Like, a bunch of people out there in the world, all around the world, have already tested this, and babies seem to love it, children seem to love it, and it seems to work, and now you can try it, right, to see if it would work for you. So it's really as simple as that, you know, and this is something you can do, too, at home with your baby, okay? I've given you some suggestions, you know, that seem to work for babies around the world. Use those as starting points, okay, and then ultimately see what works for your baby. Really, only your observation skill, your testing over and over, can help you decide what works for them. So let's just keep going and see how this child we've been talking about, you know, now that he, you know, he's reached 12 years old and he enters adolescence, you know, what does he need? What is he like? And what are some of the environments that Montessori recommends for him? So just follow me back a little bit. You know, during the first 6 years, he went through, like, these enormous changes, right? Physically, emotionally, psychologically, you name it, okay? In between 6 and 12, there's a relatively calm and stable period. And what he really experiences during that time is huge intellectual growth, okay? Then we reach the adolescent, the 12 to 18-year-olds, okay? This is another period of instability and creation, okay? This is what we call the third plane. So the third plane of development brings another rebirth. But it's not the birth of an individual like they experienced, you know, when they were newborns. But this is the birth of the social man, okay? This is the time when Montessori says, when the social man is created but has not yet reached full development. So the physical changes that come with puberty are very dramatic. The only other time he experiences that much physical change is during the years from birth to 3, okay? That's why the adolescent needs more sleep. His sleep rhythm changes. He's more susceptible to illness. He will complain about growing pains and often complain about feeling weak. You know, I remember when I was 13, you know, I would suddenly wake up, you know, in the middle of the night during these, like, various stretches of my, you know, adolescent years with sharp pain in my legs. And I would wake up, you know, and I didn't know what was happening. But then I realized it was because I was growing in my sleep. And my legs were literally just, you know, hurting. So many of you have experienced that kind of thing, you know, whether you remember it or not. So now even more interesting are the hidden physical changes that are happening in the brain, okay? And these are things that Montessori didn't know about, right, back then. But in recent years, with the current brain research, a lot of these things are coming to light. So using MRI technology, researchers are able to prove that certain areas of the brain grow and change during adolescence. So, like the prefrontal cortex, which is located behind the forehead, it controls planning, working memory, organization, and it helps modulate your mood, okay? So this part of the brain is not fully developed until well into early adulthood, like 22, 23. In fact, what we are seeing is during this time, okay, between 12 and 15, there's full-blown synaptic growth going on in the brain. So remember we talked about in the last course about synapse happening, right? That every time the child has an experience, the synapse happens. Now this is a time when there's this, like, amazing exuberance of synaptic growth going on in the brain. And it's second only to the amazing synaptic growth that took place between birth and 3. So science shows that this full-blown growth, this overproduction of synapse that happens, is what causes the adolescent brain to function so inefficiently. So this is a time when the adolescent needs more experiences, just like he did when he was a baby, and those experiences shape the growth, okay, and prune the less efficient pathways in the brain so that the prefrontal cortex can grow and mature. And that by the time they reach their teenage years, you know, that is in place, and they are able to reason better, use better judgment, and exhibit better impulse control. Okay? So this is, like, proven by brain science. Okay? Now, psychologically, the adolescent is also, anyone who's been around 12 and 13-year-olds will tell you this, they're highly unstable, and they experience mood swings, violent emotions, a lot of doubts and hesitation. Right? We've all been there, right? So we were all adolescents once. So and they were very sensitive to criticism, ridicule, and humiliation. Okay? Now, Montessori also said that during this time, the adolescent actually has decreased intellectual abilities and has difficulty concentrating. Well, there's so much going on in the brain, so much going on in the body as well, that, you know, no wonder, okay? Now, what this means is that at the time when we would expect this older child to be more responsible, more capable, to do better academically, and be more independent in general, the adolescent seems to regress. And now he can do less than what, you know, his mom, dad, teacher, and society in general expects, you know, than when he was in elementary school. He seemed like a more mature child, you know, when he was between 6 and 12. Now, so given that these are all the circumstances that's happening to him, unfortunately, in the typical middle school, children take on very challenging classes with tons of homework, different teacher for every subject, so teachers hardly get to know, you know, only get to know them a little bit, right? They have pressure to get good grades. There's hundreds of students that they're competing with. And, you know, and they're finally getting, you know, kind of surrounded by some negative influences in school. Okay, like they're now more cognizant of that. Now, Montessori, however, she thought differently. She advocated a whole different kind of environment than the typical conventional school that children go to today. She wanted to prepare the adolescent for adult life, both socially and economically, in a safe, protected environment. She realized that during these years, adolescents are not just looking for themselves, they're really looking for their place in the larger social setting. You know, she said, quote, "We should abandon the schoolroom and open the gate of life. We should create a center for work and study in the quiet countryside." Okay, she wanted to create an environment where the daily life would revolve around the changing needs of this adolescent. Okay, she believed this, quote, "If young people at a certain point are called upon to take an active part in the life of humanity, they must first feel that they have a great mission to accomplish and prepare themselves for it." So she proposed what we now call the farm school. Also, in the name she used was the Earth Kinder, okay? So it's a place that gives the 12 to 15-year-old a place to explore where they belong in a larger society, you know, while living amongst each other. So it's a boarding school, and, you know, small groups of adolescents live together, okay? They live away from home. So, you know, they go home for the holidays, and parents can come and visit during the academic year, you know, et cetera. And when parents come to visit, you know, the children run, the adolescent, they run a bed and breakfast where the parents can stay, okay? So every day they're assigned chores, such as milking the cow, feeding the chickens, taking care of the bed and breakfast, cleaning, et cetera. So they usually start their day by doing these chores, okay, followed by classes and individual studies. So Montessori believed that these children needed more sleep. So their days don't begin, you know, till like maybe 7:30, okay? So, you know, relatively, you know, I mean, some schools here, you know, the children need to be out of bed at 6 to get to school. So, no, Montessori said that, you know, they need more sleep, they need more rest. So they get up at like 7:30 or so, they do these chores, and then they go to class, and they have individual studies. They do a lot of studies using agriculture as a vehicle. For example, instead of studying chemistry, they study soil chemistry, okay? You know, they also raise animals, they grow food, they sell the surplus at farmers market, you know, and that's part of their study in economics. So, for example, you know, they'll learn to tap maple trees and sell maple syrup, maintain beehives and sell honey, or maintain a garden and sell the produce, you know, at the local market. They also study the history of civilization from early human civilization to the present and discover what causes it to thrive and what causes it to disappear. They also study science and politics, okay? Now, what's different is at the Earth Kinder, at the farm school, all the academic studies are woven into each other, okay? And so, you know, things are not like, it's not like you go to science class, you go to a history class, you go to language arts class. No, everything is woven together, and there's an emphasis on studying human groups. Because like we said earlier, this is a child who's now becoming the social man, right? He's like the social newborn. So he's like really learning and very interested in how humans come together and fall apart and these civilizations come together and fall apart and things like that. So, you know, as they're spending a lot of time thinking about who humans are and how we live together, ultimately they're thinking who they are, okay? But we don't let them, you know, get too much in their head. So a lot of the physical labor, you know, taking care of animals, taking care of plants, you know, being really merged in this nature environment really helps them stay balanced, okay? So there are adults who live on the farm with these children. They're called Earth Kinder parents, you know. They're usually very good role models for the children with, you know, usually it's a couple in a relationship, okay? And underneath the Earth Kinders are permanent staff who teach, you know, various areas. And they also bring in visiting specialists. So, for example, if children have a special interest in ceramics, you know, ceramic artists will get invited and things like that. So, you know, adolescents, they really face a crisis, right? And Montessori was very aware of that. And so there's a lot of studying and experimentation that they do, you know, on who they are individually in a social group. They'll try out many different personas. You know, am I like the cool guy? Am I like the cool kid? Or am I like the, you know, the nerdy one? Or am I like the drama kid, you know? So they get to try out many different personas. And it's something that's really hard to do with parents. You know, parents, they're like, you know, just be yourself, right? But for them, it's very important to try those on, and it's easier for them to do it when they're surrounded by peers. So they have a lot of opportunity for self-expression. They do a lot of drama where they can act out different characters. They also, you know, have debates, write documentary films. There's music, theater, et cetera, okay? So the Earth Kinder was something that was never actualized by Montessori, okay, because she died too early. But it was something she wrote about a lot. And Montessorians who have studied with her, her son, Mario Montessori, collaborated with, you know, a lot of her students, and they have created several farm schools, you know, in various parts of the United States. From what I understand, it only exists in the United States, okay? Now, some people, they cannot attend, you know, they don't want their children to go far away, or they can't afford it, or you know, it's just simply, you know, not something they choose to do. There is something called an urban compromise. So in these schools, children, they don't live in a school. They live at home, but they take several long trips a year, and they go and visit special locations for their studies. For example, they may go on a 6-week trip to an archaeological site where they live together, they live in tents, and they cook together, and they work and study on the site. They also have opportunities to apprentice under various local businesses. For example, when I was teaching at a toddler classroom, there was a middle schooler who would come every day for an hour to assist in the classroom, okay, because that he was apprenticing to see if he wanted to be, you know, a preschool teacher, okay? And others, they can go to architect's office or doctor's office and things like that, okay? So this really gives them the opportunity to see the real side of a profession before they choose to jump in. So I personally never visited an Earth Kinder, even though I'm fascinated and I really want to go one day. But I did watch a video that NAMTA, which is the North American Montessori Teachers Association, they're a very big association here in the United States. They came out with a video, and I was really amazed to watch the interviews with these 12 and 13-year-olds. They just seemed way more grounded than any other 13-year-old that I've really ever met in person. So that was very cool, you know. And I personally know three people who have gone to Earth Kinders who are now adults in their 20s. And two of them told me that their years at the Earth Kinder were the best years of their life. Okay. And so that struck me as, like, pretty amazing. Okay. Now, once the adolescents reach 15 years old, some choose to continue to go to a Montessori school, high school. You know, there's one in Cleveland, Ohio, which is pretty well known, you know, and others choose to go off to traditional high schools. But it really doesn't matter. I mean, at that point, they really can go anywhere. Overall, the children do very well academically, and they're very balanced, well-rounded individuals. Okay. So, you know, as a child finishes high school, you know, he reaches 18, and he's at his fourth plane of development, which is the plane of maturity. Okay. So the child who comes through the Montessori system has a really good idea of what he wants to do by the time he reaches 18. Montessori calls the period between 18 and 24 the period of social consciousness. Okay, during these years, the individual is very aware of what's happening in the bigger society and usually very interested in exploring different ways to make a difference in society. Okay, so a lot of them end up doing volunteer work, you know, Teach for America, you know, Peace Corps and things like that. It's very, very common. So they're generally, you know, studying in the university or they're preparing for a vocation in a vocational school, okay? You know, a vocational school really gives them the language and the jargon they need for their profession, you know? And the question they're asking is, what do I want in my life and what is my contribution, okay? And if they've been raised Montessori the whole way, they really have a lifelong love of learning. And these are children who have never taken exams before, for the most part, at least up until they're 15, and they have no fears of exams or being judged in that way, which is very different from the way I think most of us grew up, right? So I really love that. These individuals are usually very decisive. You know, they're not searching souls that waffle back and forth and, oh, should I do this or should I do that, you know, which, you know, many people nowadays, it's just very common to spend like 10 years, like, or 20 years or, you know, however long to just, you know, try this and try that and, you know, oh, I'm looking for myself. You know, a lot of people in their 20s, you know, that's what occurs, like they're looking for themselves. But these individuals who come through this whole system, you know, usually can find their way into social settings and they know how to get what they need in the system. Okay, they have a lot of respect for people, and they feel very appreciative of what they've experienced in their lives. And they seem to be very balanced, okay, between their physical, intellectual well-being. So those are the four planes, okay? And the four planes, I want you to think about it as a scaffolding. Okay, like a building, right? You have the bottom, you have the foundation, and then you start building, you know, the first floor, the second floor, the third floor. Now, it's scaffolded, okay? Every level is dependent on the one before it. So the first plane is the most important, right? Because that's the foundation. The second plane is only as strong as the first plane. Now, the third plane builds on the second plane, and then the fourth plane builds on the third. So every plane is only as strong as its previous plane. Now, because of this, there's a fundamental importance we place on the first plane particularly of the first 3 years. There's a Chinese saying from, you know, I don't know how long it's been around, but I guess, you know, centuries, that says that by age 3, the child's life is in place. Okay, so you know, that's how important those first 3 years are. You know, many parents, they're out there, they think, oh, you know, the children, they don't understand anything, you know, they don't understand anything, you know, they just eat and sleep, you know, that's all I have to do. But really, you know, from every point of view, you know, and most importantly now that we have science, you know, brain science to prove that, really it's those first 3 years that make the most difference in a person's life. So now that you know about the four planes and the different characteristics, I want you to spend some time this week observing some older children, you know. Perhaps you can get to spend time with them or just observe them on the streets or, you know, on the bus or something, and see if you see any of the characteristics or behaviors we talked about. I'd love to hear if any of you have any kind of feedback or anything like that. Please email me or, you know, and I will forward your message on to the group as well. So that's the four planes. The next thing I want to talk about, I'm going to move right on to the assignment you have for the rest of this course, okay? In the last course, you did a lot of reading and things like that, so which is great. But in this course, the main homework assignment that you're going to have is around observation. So by the end of this course, which is June 28th, so between now and June 28th, you have 21 days, okay? Your homework assignment is to do 25 hours of observation, okay? If you have two children, you can split up that time and observe each for like 12 or 13 hours. If you have one child, you can do 25 hours on one child. If you can observe other children, that would be even better, okay, to be able to see other children. So I want you to do 25 hours, and at least 15 of those hours need to be direct observation. That means you will not be able to take care of that child, so someone else needs to be there, okay? Now, what does direct observation mean? It means I want you to sit down with pen and paper and observe the child from a distance, okay? Note the date. First thing you do is just write down the date. Take a blank sheet of paper, write down the date, the time you started, okay? And then start writing. And every 15 minutes, I want you to note the time, okay? So let's say you started at, 10 a.m., you write, and then it's 10:15, write 10:15, and then keep writing, and then 10:30, et cetera, okay? So keep track of the time. That's very important. Now, I want you to write a detailed description of what you're observing as it's happening. So the description should be objective and clear, okay? Include all the details. And, I really want you to write things down without prejudging what's significant and what's insignificant, and what's good and what's bad and what's important and what's not, okay? So don't bring your value judgments into it. Just write objectively, right? Very objectively. I want it to stay like a fly on the wall, So I really want you to maintain the perspective of your center, okay? So stay aware of yourself as well as, what you're observing or who you're observing. Avoid becoming too involved with yourself and your own reactions, okay? And avoid being too focused on the object that you're observing. The object, it could be the child, what he's playing with or what he's doing or the environment. Just don't get too honed in on one thing and just, getting too tunnel vision. I want you to maintain a sense of yourself and keeping peripheral vision while observing your child at the same time. Describe what's happening, but avoid speculating too much about what you're observing, okay? So don't jump to conclusions. So this is what we call a narrative description, okay? A narrative description is the activity that will really hone your patience, okay? Because Montessori herself, she was a scientist, okay? And we want to cultivate the patience of a scientist, okay? if you're observing an insect, like you said, it takes hours and hours and hours of just watching, right, to observe what it is. I mean, thank God we're not observing insects. Our children are going to be way more interesting. And most of us, we were with our kids all the time, but we really don't have the luxury of sitting down and writing down something all about them. It's also just maybe something wonderful to have in the future. So I want you to wait and watch to see what will be revealed. And I want you to be detached from any concerns with like a particular outcome or a particular result. Okay? And then as you're watching an event happen, after that event is over, I want you to sit down and start writing your interpretive response underneath, okay? So an interpretive response is an opportunity to do two things. It's to, you know, gather together your own subjective responses to the observation, and it's also to begin to interpret the significance of what you've observed, okay? So first you create a very detached, you know, first you create a detached and brief description of your feelings and your responses to what you've just described, okay? It's important to note and acknowledge your subjective responses because this is where your own unconscious prejudices, expectations, and history can emerge, okay? So in this way, like every observation, it can become an opportunity for self-examination, and it can enhance your knowledge of yourself. So you start the interpretive response by writing down how you feel about it and what are your, or if you notice like, oh, I really wanted this to happen, or oh, I thought that was good, or I thought that was bad, you know, that kind of thing. Like, it doesn't matter. Don't, you know, just let your feelings come out, okay? But once you've done that, gather together any ideas you have to explain the possible meaning of what you've just observed, okay? Be rigorous in basing your explanation and knowledge that you've had up to this point, okay? All of you have, you know, by now you've really learned a lot. I mean, we've done 7 sessions now, and you really know a lot, okay? And I'm sure that all of you have gone home and you've observed your children. So I want you to base your explanations in your knowledge and your experience, and not so much on your feelings and subjective response, okay? So it's just, you know, as you're growing, as your own knowledge grows, okay, in your experience in child development and, you know, how to create an environment that's best for them and all of that, you know, there's always going to be a gap between your present level of knowledge, experience, and in the future, right? There's always a gap. You know, no matter where you are, you know, so you just have to trust that increasing knowledge married with ever-expanding experience will support the cultivation of a bio-discernment leading over time to wisdom, okay? So just be aware of that, that it doesn't matter. You don't have to do it right. You don't have to think, oh, I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm just making stuff up. No, you know what you know up to now, and you really know a lot, and just trust that, okay? What I found is that, you know, creating these interpretive responses, it really hones your humility, okay? And, you know, as parents, you know, or as educators who want to, you know, who really, like, feel there's something awesome about following the child, right? The whole Montessori idea of following the child. You know, you really need to be very humble to be somebody who's willing to follow the child. And so in creating these interpretive responses, you know, you have to have the humility of a scientist who can admit that you don't know everything and that you can embrace the possibility that there is more to every situation than what you see, okay? There's more underneath, okay? Humility allows us to work tirelessly at tasks that, you know, are small and insignificant. So you know, humility is absolutely necessary if we want to let the child be our guide, okay? Now, after each narrative description that you create an interpretive response, okay? Now, how often you create interpretive responses and how much you write, you know, that's really open to you, okay? You know, you decide. You can do it at the end of each session, or you can do it more often, or you can do it at the end of every, you know, you can do it several times during the session. It's really up to you. But it is very important to do both the narrative description and the interpretive response, okay? So now Now, the rest of your hours can be spent doing indirect observation. That means you have a pen and paper ready. So remember, just now we talked about 15 hours of direct observation, okay, where you're just writing. Now, the other 10 hours you can spend doing indirect observation. That means you have a pen and paper ready. You know, you could be taking care of the child, you know, and when you're able to, you go and you write down everything you can remember, okay? Sometimes it may be like after an hour or two have gone by and you finally get the chance to sit down and write what you saw. So that's wonderful. That's fine. Just do that, okay? So I know that all of you are parents and you have, not all of you, but many of you are parents, and some of you work with children, and so this way you can have a little bit of leeway. Because I also want you to be cognizant of the observation that you are doing, even when you're not writing it down, okay? So I want you specifically to look at a few areas. I want you to look at movement, okay, including equilibrium. Equilibrium is, you know, whether they're crawling or they're sitting or, you know, or maybe they're just at the beginning, wherever they're at with their equilibrium, gross body movement, as well as hand movement, okay? So I gave you guys, like, a timeline of the gross motor development and the hand fine motor development. So I don't know if you guys took notes or if you remember any of that, but I want you to keep that in the back of your head, and think about, you know, like, are they grasping? Are they using their thumb? Is the thumb involved? Or is it just their palm, you know? Do they hold on to it for a long time, or do they let it go? You know, things like that, okay? I also want you to look at communication, okay? How do they communicate with you? You know, is it, you know, what are, you know, it's like there's so much to communication. It's through the eyes. It's babbling. It's their interest in your mouth movement. But the body language, you know, so much of it is about the body language. So I really want you to focus on the communication. They're feeding, okay? If they're drinking milk or breastfeeding, you know, if they're breastfeeding or bottle fed, how often they're being fed, and if they're eating solids and things like that. Also, their sleep and awake pattern, okay? That's pretty self-explanatory. I also want you to focus and look at their level of independence. Are they independent? You know, can they spend long stretches of time by themselves playing with something, or do they always want, you know, calling out and, you know, wanting attention and wanting to be with you? And also if they're eating, you know, how are they? Do they like to try to grab the food and eat it by themselves, you know? Or do they sit there passively and let you feed them, you know? So all those kinds of things, you know, how engaged are they with you when you're, you know, changing them or feeding them, things like that. I also want you to look at cognitive development. So what are the toys that they're playing with? Which are the toys that they're interested in? You know, colors or sounds. You know, I want you to focus on perhaps like the visual sense, the auditory sense, and the tactile sense, okay? So visual, auditory, and tactile, which of those are they using and which of those are they interested in? And which toys, you know, activate those three senses? And then I want you to look at social development. You know, how are they with, do they have a sibling? You know, do they have a twin? A lot of you have twins. How are they with you know, mom and dad? Do they play with other children? Do they ever socialize with other children? As we know, the child in the first year, you know, and really the first 6 years, I would say, you know, they're very focused on themselves, right? I mean, it's most obvious in the first year, but there's definitely an interest in other children and other people. So I really want you to take a note of that. And lastly, I want you to look at their emotional development. Okay. You know, what are they communicating their emotions? You know, how do you know? How can you tell? How are they doing it? And, you know, what happens if you don't go to them immediately? You know, and what happens when you do? So all of those details I want you to consider and think about. Okay. So, so your narrative response and your interpretive response. I'm going to ask you to turn these in to me before the last course on June 28th. I will simply read through them. Perhaps I'll give you a few comments, but it's really just to check that you did it, okay? Because like Montessori says, you know, we have to be prepared to observe. And what does that mean? That means by observing, we're preparing ourselves for future observation, okay? So how are we gonna become more prepared is by observing more. So very few parents ever get the chance to sit down and write something about their children. And I remember, you know, when I was doing my training, we had to do 250 hours of observation of various ages between 0 and 3, and you were only allowed to observe your own children for 20 hours. So I spent 10 hours on one child, 10 hours on the other, and I actually discovered things that I hadn't noticed in my observation about my child, because I was sitting there and I had a nanny take care of them. And I was really surprised that I did that. And it really made me understand them better and able to know, you know, how to help them link them to the environment, how to help give them things that really keep their attention and keep them concentrated for a long time. So that was very cool, and I hope that you guys will also have that experience when you guys do this assignment, okay? So you can email me anytime this week to ask for further clarification. And next week I will do a full lecture on observation. So I hope that before I give that lecture, you guys will have some experience with doing this, okay? So try to have already done at least 1 or 2 hours of this. By next week, describing what you see as well as noting your interpretive response, okay? And if you'd like to send it to me just for me to look at it, you know, I can do that for you. But like I said, there's really no right or wrong way to do this. It's simply the act of doing it, okay? I know there are very few of you on the call today. I know that a lot of people have already told me that they're not going to be able to be on today, and that most of the people in this course just listen in. So, but I am going to take you guys off of mute to see if the ones who are here have any questions. So let's see here. Hi, guys. Anybody there? Still there? Okay. I see that a few of you are on the call, but maybe you don't have any questions or anything like that. Okay. So I'm going to leave it at that today. I want you to, you know, get started on your homework. I hope that you guys can hear me. Hold on. Okay, so I want you guys to get started on your homework, and I will see you guys all next week. Okay, bye now.